This is Purple Radio on demand.
Welcome back to the wonderful world of Chalkboard Ultra. I'm Sam, and joining me here, as usual, is Louis.
Hey, great to be back. So, what are we doing today, Sam?
This episode, we're continuing our journey in the Infinity Saga with the concept of an infinite series.
Oh, no. Not again.
What?
Infinity. It's here, it's there, it's everywhere all at once.
But it's also nowhere.
Right.
Because of how inconceivably big infinity is, can we ever really see it? Does it truly exist?
Well, when talking about infinity, especially in mathematics, we have to be very careful about what we mean. It's a common misconception that infinity is just the largest number in existence, but in reality, it's simply an idea of how large things can get. Of course, as I mentioned before, there are different sizes of infinity.
Well, yeah, I went to a lecture one time about infinity. It was when the maths department held a colloquia in first year. It was all about the philosophies and ideas of infinity. Does it exist and can we count it? And one of the main distinctions between two types of infinities is uncountable and countable. So if you imagine all of the numbers on a number line, just in a set, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, blah, 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 and you go on that infinitely long line, you will have a set of all the numbers, and it will be an infinitely large set, but a countable infinity, because you can actually count every item in that set. It's got its own position. But then if you look at like the real numbers between 0 and 1, there's an uncountably infinite number of them. Like, if you give me any decimal number between 0 and 1, I can always find one smaller. So you do have countably infinite sets, but then also uncountably infinite sets.
Well, here's another question, Sam. Is the set of all sets a set?
If the set of all sets is a set, then that set would have to contain itself. I remember my mind being blown first learning about set theory, and I'm so glad I don't have to do it anymore. Something we should also mention is, yes, infinity is infinitely large. There's also the idea of being infinitesimally small.
Well, that's studied heavily in calculus, right?
Yeah. So calculus is the study of how objects and ideas change over time. But it's not like a general overall change. It's an instantaneous change at every infinitesimally small moment in time. For example, you can look at how a car changes its speed over time. I mean, that's just
acceleration.
Yeah, the ideas of acceleration. But that car is moving constantly. It's not like its acceleration just changes from one number to another. There's got to be some kind of continuum limit there. And so you need to look at the instantaneous change in speed over an infinitesimally small amount of time. And that's how we calculate velocity when talking about calculus. And it's something you can also look in climatology, like how weather and temperature changes at every single instant. And a question I'll get back to shortly is actually about weather records and how they're broken.
Let's discuss the concept of infinite series then.
Well, first, a series begins with a series of numbers or objects that all follow the same pattern, depending on their position in this sequence. And what I mean by that is that the first thing has got to do with number one, the second to do with two, the third to do with three, and so on. Do you have that?
Yeah, so if we take the even numbers, let's say, you know, 2 times 1, then the second will be 2 times 2, third will be 2 times 3, and so on and so on.
And that carries on forever, right? Now, what a standard series would do is take that sequence and add up each term up to some endpoint. So if your even number example, you could ask, you know, what is the sum of all even numbers up to, say, 50? And a fun little exercise takes you to just over 2,000. But an infinite series, on the other hand, you know, you might imagine, they would ask you to add up all of these terms endlessly, which might actually take a while.
What are the necessary conditions for an infinite series to converge, then?
Well, clearly, adding up all these numbers that get bigger and bigger will just lead you to infinity. Like 2 plus 4 plus 6 plus 8, it will go on forever. And there's no stopping that. The numbers moving through the sequence have to shrink in size. It's like your example, you're adding up 1, and a half, and a quarter, and an eighth, and a sixteenth, and they're actually getting smaller and smaller because they're fractions.
So it will make it more likely to converge to something other than infinity.
Yeah. But of course, this isn't true for every sum of fractions. Let me diverge for a moment. suppose we have a list of rainfall figures for about 100 years. How many record-breaking falls of rain do you expect to have taken place over this period?
Well, assuming the rainfall figures are random and independent.
Well, yeah, in the sense that the amount of rain in any one year is no influence on the next.
I don't know. Let's say five.
Five, sure. Well, we'll see. The first year that we recorded rainfall was undoubtedly a record year, right? Because you've got nothing else to compare it to. Then in the second year, the rain could equally likely have been more than or less than the rainfall of the first year. So there's a probability of a half that the second year was a record year, right? The expected number of record years in the first 2 years of this record keeping is therefore 1 + 1/2. And then on to the third year, the probability is 1/3 that the third observation is higher than the first two. So the expected number of record rainfalls in 3 years is 1 + 1/2 + 1/3.
Okay, so continuing this line of reasoning leads to the conclusion that the expected number of records in this list of n observations would be 1 + 1/2 + 1/3, and continuing all the way up to 1 over n.
Yeah, and out pops what we mathematicians call the harmonic series, the sum of all unit fractions.
So my guess for the number of record rainfalls in 100 years was nearly right.
Well, yeah, the sum of the first 100 terms of the harmonic series is 5.19, so yeah, you're pretty close. Now, even after a record-breaking rainfall, no one will deny that the record will be broken sometime in the future, you know, perhaps in the very next year. So the number of record years in an infinity of observations is clearly infinity.
Something like athletic records won't follow the same pattern, since they are not random in the way rainfall records are. Athletes are always trying to break the current record, and training methods are continually being improved. Nobody's doing anything about improving the weather.
No, true. But for the record, in both senses, that is where the intuition believing that the harmonic series diverges. Or put more simply, adding up all unit fractions will lead you to infinity, albeit very slowly.
So let's try to discuss some infinite series that do converge and how we can tell them. So do you remember analysis?
Oh, how could I not?
Well, they provided loads of ways to tell if a series converges. Now, if we're dealing in fractions, then it's probably best to use the alternating sum theorem.
Yeah, true. This theorem tells us that if our sequence decreases in magnitude as we move through it, then the alternating sum will converge. So if instead of 1 + 1/2 + 1/3 + 1/4 and so on, we took 1 - 1/2 + 1/3 - 1/4 and do that to infinity, this actually converges to a number. And in this case, it happens to be natural log of 2.
What other ones are there?
Well, there are a few special ones, in my eyes anyway. As we've mentioned previously, constants in nature, absolutely fascinating. And some keen mathematicians should have already met some of the main characters like pi, e, the golden ratio, the speed of light, the Pythagoras constant, the Euler-Mascheroni constant.
I think they would count as recurring characters, not necessarily main characters.
Right. Yeah, sorry, I was getting carried away again. The point is that some of our favourite constants are merely defined by an infinite series, whereas others just kind of seem to appear. Take the factorials, for example. This is a sequence of numbers where each time you move up a position, you multiply by that position. So you begin with 1, then the next one is 1 times 2, then 1 times 2 times 3, then 1 times 2 times 3 times 4, etc. And if you take the reciprocal of the factorials, you've got 1, then 1/2, then 1/6, then 1 over 24, 1 over 120, and you add all those up. This is what gives you Euler's constant E, roughly 2.718.
So we don't need to use the alternating sum theorem for that.
Well, no, lucky for us, the reciprocals of factorials get smaller and smaller fairly fast. The next term is 1 over 720 and then 1 over 5040. They're going to reach infinitesimally small in no time.
Well, one that does use the alternating sum theorem is the Madhava-Leibniz series. This is where the sum alternates in odd fractions. You've got 1 - 1/3. Plus a fifth, minus a seventh, and you do this to infinity, and you get pi over 4. Now, the result is quite strange. With the sum of reciprocal factorials, I can see where e comes from, because it hints at some exponential growth.
Yeah.
But here, there's no circle. So where exactly does the pi appear?
Well, it doesn't directly link to circles, but whenever pi is involved, you'll always be able to link it back to circles.
Are you sure about this?
Yeah, I might do a dissertation in that. I love pi.
Pi or tau?
I am a pi man. I don't use tau enough to represent 2 pi. For listeners that don't know, there's a ongoing mathematical debate whether or not we should be using tau instead of pi, where tau is just equal to 2 pi. So everyone's favorite formula for the circumference of a circle is pi times the diameter, or 2 pi times the radius. So you can just instead say tau r. But then if you've got the area of a circle pi r squared, you're then going to have tau r squared on 4. And I'm not a massive fan of that. Oh yeah, tau r squared on 2. I don't like that as much.
Pi is clearly more famous.
Yeah.
In fact, you know there's a Wikipedia page of all the equations involving pi.
Really? How'd you come across that?
Well, I like looking through Wikipedia. It's my way of doing some recreational maths.
Reading wiki pages.
It is a rabbit hole. It could be a lot of fun. On my wiki adventure, I stumbled on a page about the Basel problem. And unfortunately, that led me to some scary depths about the Riemann hypothesis.
Oh, the Basel problem. One of my favourites. Tell everyone about it, then.
The problem is an infinite series of the reciprocals of the squares and takes its name after Basel, the hometown of Leonard Euler, the mathematician who is said to have first solved it. The series goes 1 plus a quarter plus a ninth plus a sixteenth and so on and so on. And this series sums to pi squared over 6. Now, we might say, where does the pi come from? But here's a better question. Where does the pi squared come from?
You never see pi squared anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, there is a lovely geometric proof online that's done by Grant Sanderson on his YouTube channel, 3Blue1Brown. Definitely check it out, listeners. But I'll kind of give a brief overview. It is very geometric, very visual, but I'll try it orally. It begins with you standing by a lake with a lighthouse that's one unit away from you. And that lighthouse is emitting some kind of light, and that's got a certain brightness. And at a very human experience level, the closer the lighthouse is to you, the brighter it would seem, and vice versa, if it's further away from you, the dimmer it would be.
Okay, so one might ask how much the brightness changes as you move between these distances.
Yeah, and because brightness is something to do with light, which is a wave, it follows the inverse square law. The brightness of the lighthouse is proportional to the inverse of the distance squared. It's a physics thing that's used in, you know, all over the place. But essentially, if a lighthouse one unit away from you emits some brightness, then it being 2 units away will have 1 over 2 squared, or 1 quarter of the brightness. And being 3 units away emits brightness 1 over 3 squared, or 1 over ninth. So can you see where this is going? If you place a lighthouse at every unit away from you, all with the same brightness, then the total brightness of all the lighthouses put together is 1 plus a quarter, plus a ninth, plus a 16th.
There's the Basel problem. I'm trying my best to remember that this is actually a thought experiment and we don't have an infinite number of lighthouses to hand. But then again, I was the one that sold you on the idea that we can have an infinite number of monkeys and typewriters. So
true. It's all a bit abstract.
I will stay quiet.
Yeah. But you can see how this infinite array of lighthouses is simply just a representation of the Basel problem. And our question has now become, what is this total brightness?
But how does this answer the actual question that we were trying to ask?
Well, yeah, it does seem like the same question, doesn't it? It is better explained in the video, but you can imagine yourself at a circular lake and the circumference is 2 and the lighthouse is directly opposite you. The distance that lighthouse away from you is just the diameter of this circle, and because the diameter is the ratio between the circumference and pi, that distance is 2 over pi.
And then by the inverse square law, the brightness would be 1 divided by 2 divided by pi all squared.
Yeah, and if you do the algebra, it's pi squared over 4. And there's some fiddly algebra and geometry that will lead you to the desired result, pi squared over 6. I will leave it as an exercise for the listener.
So we've discussed these challenging ways you can actually solve infinite series and find their quite nice results, I'd say. But is there a general way of finding them?
Well, one could argue that a lot of them stem from Taylor series. For the listeners, a Taylor series is a special type of polynomial that's used to create an estimate of what some functions look like around any given point. For example, if you want to take a look at any trig function, sine, cosine, about the origin, you can use its Taylor series polynomial expansion for it.
So these series expansions and approximations were best used before the invention of calculators, and it would help approximate your special function. So, for instance, you wanted to find sine pi over 7 or the natural log of 2.
Yeah, true. I remember the first time I learned about this when I was doing the A-level and further maths. Our teacher brought up a 3Blue1Brown video. Again, amazing visuals, amazing visuals. And I won't go into too much of the maths behind it, but it essentially takes infinite number of derivatives to get this polynomial. Lots of lovely calculus. It shows you how a graph kind of shapes around this point. But we have to remember it is an approximation. Starting from this specific point, you can use your derivatives to figure out how the function would change as you move away from it. A Taylor series is just math speak for eyeballing it.
So you mean it's akin to a proof by inspection. We've inspected the way that the function moves, or curves rather, so it must be of this particular form.
Well, maybe. This series is completed by adding up this infinite number of derivatives.
Can this be used for every function? For instance, you've got trigonometric functions, I think you've got complex functions as well. Transcendental functions, what about them?
Well, all the ones that you encounter, I would say day-to-day because you are a mathematician, but most people actually don't. I should say smooth functions. There's a big debate going on in maths and physics on what smooth actually means, but it's essentially you can take this infinite number of derivatives and life is good. I could be more precise and say that the polynomials are only valid in a small neighborhood around this point. But clearly, if you end up adding powers of large numbers together without any division, then you end up diverging.
Well, I recall being introduced to Maclaurin series before Taylor series. Do you remember them?
Yes.
Yeah, Colin Maclaurin.
What a name.
Yeah, what a name. This is where the Taylor series starts at the origin, x equals zero. And I think it's actually quite a better way of easing people into Taylor series because everyone loves the origin.
Yeah.
Of course, by the time uni gets along, you've got loads more to learn. The Lagrange remainder, Fourier series.
Oh, I'm glad you brought up Fourier series, actually, because they have much wider applications in applied maths. These type of series deal with adding up infinite periodic functions like your sine and cosine, and they help us approximate waves and other repeated patterns.
Any specific examples?
Well, without the Fourier series, we wouldn't be able to use this lovely studio. When processing signals such as audio, radio waves, light waves, seismic waves, a lot of images as well, Fourier analysis concentrates a lot of components for easier detection or removal, really. And a large family of signal processing techniques consist of Fourier transforms, manipulating this data, and kind of reversing this transformation. They're used in places like equalization of audio recordings, image processing, and sound spectrograms.
A rather rogue one, but I once read about a student who was analyzing data generated by a person running on a force plate. Now, since the force exerted on your feet from running is for the most part periodic, it's in a pattern. So they could fit the data with a curve using Fourier analysis. The work could then be used to help develop better running shoes.
See, that's so cool. Mm. And in fact, I think Shazam, the music recognition software, it actually identifies music by comparing the Fourier decomposition of recorded sound to a large data bank of Fourier decompositions of well-known songs.
So every song has its own unique decomposition.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a unique ID.
Yeah, song ID. Like those codes you can scan on Spotify, they're unique to every song. Maybe that's the Fourier decomposition of the song. I should look that up, probably. Some of our listeners might know. Please write in.
Well, unlike our infinite series, this podcast must terminate at some point.
Too true. We don't want to diverge any further.
Always integrating the jokes in quite well, aren't you, Sam?
Yeah, very smooth.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Chalkboard Ultra. We hope you found it as enlightening as we did.
Join us next time as we delve deeper into the wonders of mathematics. And please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Chalkboard Ultra.
Keep safe.
And keep well.
Hey, no.
What?
It's chalkboard time. You can't read during podcast time.
I've got some work to do. I'm hosting a cocktail party this weekend.
No alcohol. You're not allowed to drink here.
I'm hosting a cocktail party this weekend. I need to figure out what...
Oh, stop trying to get the viewers to... Not viewers. Stop trying to get the listeners to sympathize with you. Pour me a drink. No more bartending books.
Damn it. Better pick that up. I got that from a vintage bookstore in Los Angeles. It's got over 2,300 cocktail recipes, a lot of them non-alcoholic, and it cost me only $4. It's amazing.
I wonder if there's any whiskey cocktails.
There are.
I literally just turned to a
There's an entire chapter on whiskey. I looked at the index, tried to find some interesting names of cocktails.
Mathematical cocktails.
Well, there is a cocktail in here called Dr. Funk, which I think if you adapt it a little bit, turn it to Professor Funk, I think Jens will be very happy with that one. Genuinely, reading wiki articles is a rabbit hole that I do far too often. I could be doing some assignment for a class and I need to look something up, and then I just go down this big, huge spiral of Wikipedia articles. So the most interesting ones are looking at people and who they're connected to, a bit like Erdős numbers.
Well, I think we'll get to Erdős numbers a bit soon, Sam, but we shouldn't tempt fate. So here's one on math jokes and the weird stuff that can happen. So one math joke that always stood out to me was a joke done by Leigh Mercer where he made a limerick. It goes, a dozen a grosser score plus 3 times the square root of 4 divided by 7 plus 5 times 11 is 9 squared and not a bit more.
That was nice.
Yeah, and it's cool to have something that works just nicely. He was known for his wordplay and, again, another recreational mathematician.
I like that we talked a little bit about calculus in the episode. Reminds me of another joke. Louis, what's the integral of 1 over cabin with respect to cabin?
Log cabin.
No, a houseboat. You forgot to add the C. Got it, right? There are only 10 types of people in the world. Those who understand binary.
And those who don't.
And those who didn't realise this was a joke in base 3.
Purple Radio Podcasts. Thanks for downloading this Purple Radio podcast. For more great content and to listen live, head to purpleradio.co.uk.